Happy Friday, everybody. It's the Information's 411, your weekly look from the reporting team at the Information. The biggest stories that we wrote during the week and the behind-the-scenes look at how these stories came together. My name is Tom Dotton. I am a reporter here at the Information. Two parts in today's episode. First off, I'm talking to Priya Anand. She wrote a piece about the origin stories at tech companies and whether or not they are true. It's kind of this thing in the tech world that every company wants to have its special, cool, unique tale on how it was first launched. And if you really look deeper into the accuracy of these stories, there's a lot more there. And you know, the story both looks at which companies have sort of either by their own doing or just generally happened over time, inflated their origin story, and also what it means, why it is that companies should want to create myth around how it was founded. And then I'm talking to Kevin McLaughlin about the biggest fight in enterprise tech between Rubrik and Cohesity. One-time friends, similar origins, now bitter rivals. No one does enterprise tech like Kevin, so I'm excited to talk to him about the Cohesity Rubrik battle. All right, that's it for this episode. Before I get to the interviews, though, I should quickly thank everyone who came out to our recent Hong Kong summit. That was very successful, a lot of fun, and so I've heard, and look forward to seeing subscribers at the next one. All right, let's get on over to my convo with Priya. All right, Priya, so you took on an interesting challenge recently when you decided to look at origin stories for tech companies and basically burst the bubble on some of these self-created mythologies that they have. But also, and what I want to kind of talk to you about is like why it's even necessary to have a sort of pumped up origin story. So I think before we get into the specifics, I figure I should just ask, I mean, what is it about origin stories that made you interested? Like why kind of tackle this topic?
I mean, out here, you often hear about just these like cute, super convenient stories about how in my childhood, X happened. And, you know, like 20 years later, I'm founding a company to do this thing that solves that problem. And sometimes it's like a really, it's sort of a middle of the road mythology where it's not necessarily connected to an ailment someone's loved one faced and finding a cure for it or something deeply personal. It's kind of random sometimes. For example, in the case of Hims, which we wrote about, it was like my sister made fun of my dry skin, so I created, you know, like a men's wellness company, which is like, you know, that's a personal experience, but it's not necessarily, it's like my sister made fun of my dry skin, right?
Right.
It's not that serious.
Well, it's not like
that emotional.
Thing.
It's not
sure.
A grand thing. It's
right.
Like there are so many of these like middle of the road sort of mythologies created where they're like really convenient and they're not necessarily purporting to be like solving this deeply emotional thing that someone has a connection to or a family connection to or anything. They're just like these sort of middle of the road like silly little stories that like
right.
match whatever the product is at hand. And you see so much of this in the Valley, I think because companies want to be memorable, right? Like when you're a startup and you're, you know, fighting to survive every day and pouring all your money into marketing to get people to pay attention. Like you want them to maybe remember your cute story.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it makes it seem like there's maybe like a grander vision.
A grander
here.
Vision.
Right.
Everyone here loves to say they're saving the world. And
right.
a venture capitalist said this to me when we were talking for this story. Like everyone out in the Valley wants to say that money is like a byproduct of their service, right? Like we started this thing to
right.
connect
really
the world.
We're just philanthropists. Like we but in the end, you know, if we happen to make money doing it, well, okay, it's not a bad side benefit. But
yeah.
really this is about the true, you know, ethical and moral force that is the reason I started it in the first place.
Yeah. And so after Mark Zuckerberg gave his speech a couple of weeks ago at Georgetown talking about freedom of expression, there was a lot of backlash from even members of Congress who were upset because he started off the speech saying something about how, you know, he was in college at Harvard when the U.S. made the decision to go into Iraq for the Iraq War, and that affected his thought process while he was developing Facebook in terms of giving people a way to express themselves and their beliefs, et cetera. And a lot of people saw this as revisionist history. because, you know, Facebook was, it's well documented, it was started as a hot or not rating system on Harvard's campus that Zuckerberg created. You know, while he didn't quite say, like, this is why I started Facebook, he did attribute, you know, like, he connected the dots a little bit and said, like, this affected my thought process while I was starting Facebook in terms of giving people a voice to express their thoughts and beliefs. And he said something about how maybe things could have been different if people had a way to do that around the time when the Iraq War was getting started. And this made some folks very upset, made some members of Congress very upset who were quoted in other publications, who felt like, you know, you can't try to rewrite your history. And Facebook told us, like, you know, it's ridiculous to imply he was trying to rewrite the company's history. He just said this informed his thought process on free expression. You know, interpret it how you will, but clearly some people saw it as an effort to rewrite Facebook's origin story to something that might be more convenient right now, particularly as they face tons of scrutiny from Washington.
Sure. Anyway, so what's interesting in looking across the list of companies that you profiled here, that you kind of dissected, was that there seems to be, why don't we just go through the list? So you mentioned Hims. Which are the other ones that you thought were interesting and worth kind of poking some holes into its inflated theories?
To be clear, the founder of Hims says his sister did criticize his appearance. And
hard to prove that he didn't.
It made him, right. And it made him realize that, you know, there's a stigma around men's wellness, et cetera. You know, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is also that, you know, these things can be true at the same time, but the company was also created out of Atomic VC, which is like sort of a startup studio incubator type of thing. They keep a running list of hundreds of ideas, and they say this publicly, that they workshop and figure out, and they have entrepreneurs in residence who then take on those companies as founders if they take off. Like, they do these tests, and, you know, they'll do some marketing, see if there's traction, if customers are interested in signing up for a wait list or whatever it is. And if there's traction, they'll build the company. And actually, that's an interesting way to approach it, because otherwise, like, what if you're just shooting in the dark off of some random idea? At least they know there's traction on it, right? But, you know, it makes it convenient to have a nice origin story associated with something as well. I mean, one of the most famous examples of this was eBay, which Pierre Amadeur said that his partner, collected Pez dispensers, and that eBay was created something as a way to, you know, better facilitate the trading of Pez dispensers or whatever. And he's admitted in interviews that this was not true. The part that she, you know, was interested in Pez dispensers is true, but it's not why he made eBay. But he said it helped him connect with people who are looking for some, like, specific thing and you know, create a marketplace that might help foster that. But everyone wants a convenient story.
Right, right. The other one, as you were talking, and I was realizing that this, it's so baked into our mindset and culture here, is Theranos. And, you know, that's obviously been reported and documented on ad mm-hmm. nauseum. But, you know, for a time, Elizabeth Holmes was going out there saying that, you know, she had an uncle that was diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, if there could have been earlier testing, perhaps her uncle could have been saved. Again, maybe I'm sure that's true to an extent, but it seems so important to something like that to get people believing emotionally that there is something greater at play here, that you have to make it very personal. And that seems to be kind of the through line through a lot of your things, right? That it's extremely personal. I mean, I guess in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, his inflated story was that there was this giant war going on that he was, you know, concerned about. But a lot of times it was like this small moment in our lives. Something happened, yeah. And there was like an aha moment.
One VC said something interesting to me. She said that, you know, everyone does this to an extent when they're crafting their resume or when they're, you know, applying for a job or whatever. Like, they connect something they did at one point to, you know, something they're doing now and how it will help them. Though I think that's slightly different from saying it's why you did something. But the reason companies and founders do this is when you're going and you're pitching venture capitalists and you're trying to get funding in this very crowded space where they're listening to pitches all day and you need to stand out, and there might be like five companies doing the same thing, basically.
how do you get that money? You become memorable in some way, or you have a really crisp, clean story, or you show that you are the founder who is so compelled by whatever it was to solve whatever problem you claim you're addressing, or do whatever thing you said you're going to do. It's part of like the passion story too, and why you'll survive against all the odds as a startup.
What do you think it means for people that work at the companies? I don't know if that kind of came up in your reporting process.
It did actually. I spoke with people both in, you know, PR and in venture who said, like, actually this is helpful for recruiting too, because you want employees to feel like there's a mission to be connected to. And sometimes that comes from like creating a a set of values, a set of corporate values or a corporate mission statement type of thing. But sometimes it comes from, you know, people hearing that founding story and feeling really connected to that and connected to that problem or empathetic for whatever the cause is. And it's hard to recruit out here, and particularly in getting, you know, higher level executives, what I've been told is, you know, having that compelling factor behind you is helpful.
Yeah, it seems to also kind of follow or fall into the cult of personality of the founder, right?
Totally. Yeah. It's a huge part of that. I mean, everyone knows how big of a thing that is in the Valley, so I don't even know if we need to get into it. But, you know, and that reminds me, actually, speaking of the cult of the founder, Uber, you know, in Mike Isaac's book, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners have read, you know, the Uber origin story goes something like Travis Kalanick and Garrett Camp were in Paris at a conference and, you know, came up with the idea for Uber because they realized how hard it is to get cabs. The actual origin story is a lot more complicated, and Mike outlines it in his book. And it's a lot of like they talked through the idea. Garrett had the idea while watching Casino Royale and seeing the car move across, or an arrow move across Bond's phone. And he talked to Travis about it as Jam Pad before they even went to Paris. And then in Paris, that's where Travis sort of became more interested than he was previously. And then they came back and, you know, a while later, Travis actually signed on to work with him on it. But, you know, that's not as great of a story.
Right.
It's long-winded. Like, no one wants to hear 17 sentences on how you founded the company.
It's tougher in a pitch. And the last thing I want to bring up, and I found interesting here, is that the role that incubators have played in a lot of these companies. Because an incubator is essentially a organization or like a system that is supposed to create companies. They're literally, their job is to create companies, origin story or not. It's like a laboratory. And, you know, Hims, you know, there was a role that an incubator played. Tinder came out of an incubator owned by IAC.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't come up with a more mission oriented concept than an incubator. And I think it's kind of,
and the reality of incubators is like people are often trying multiple ideas, right? Like, many, many, many startups come from, you know, the well-known pivot. Like, someone tries one idea, it doesn't work. You move to something else, you move to something else, you move to something else. That next thing finally does work. And then what do you have? Like,
right.
It's
very mechanical. It's mechanical. It's scientific. And it doesn't sort of like play on the heartstrings that people really think needs to happen for someone to emotionally connect.
Yeah, it doesn't sound as exciting when you're like going into a pitch meeting or you're recruiting employees and you're like, we created this company because we wanted to make a shit ton of money. Like, that's not
right. And it gets, I mean, look, and from
it's inspiring to some, but you know, that's why people seek out these like cute stories or try to find, like, they dig deep on like, why am I actually doing this in my heart and soul?
Yeah. And from the investor standpoint too, you know, it's like, which do I want to be connected to? Something that might actually change someone's life or something that's going to make me a lot of money. We know that the latter is what's driving.
Yeah, obviously the goal.
Yeah, is the goal, but, you know, people want to, I don't know, sleep at night. Anyway, Priya, this was a really interesting story and fascinating discussion. And I encourage everyone to check it out if they haven't already, and then talk with their friends and family about their origin stories.
And if you have examples of other ones that you think we should be looking at, that may,
this could be an ongoing feature. I like that.
Yeah, that may or may not be what they seem to be. If it's too cute, it might not be real.
Too cute to be true. That'll be what the name of the feature is. All right, Priya, thanks for joining.
Thanks.
All right, Kevin, so I'm going to be honest here, and maybe this is an embarrassing admission, that aside from the first time that you'd written about Rubrik, I was not familiar with this company. But it's a huge deal in the enterprise tech world. And Rubrik and Cohesity have you know, both they're bitter rivals, as you write in the story, but also have kind of common origins, which I suppose is typical in bitter rivalry type stories. So for those of the people out there who are maybe similar to me, why don't you just explain what Rubrik and Cohesity do?
Yeah, so actually both companies are extremely well thought out in terms of engineering and products. Like they actually, it's hard to really see any difference between them from the perspective of customers that are looking to, the whole point is that they both companies have revitalized this area of the tech industry known as backup and storage, which are kind of two separate categories, but they are together under this new umbrella called cloud data management. And what that means is instead of the old way, which was to store your data in separate systems that all had to be managed individually, these companies, Rubrik and Cohesity, have come up with a new way, which is you can put all your data kind of in one place, not physically, but sort of logically in one place, and whether it lives in the cloud or in the data center. And that's really huge because you can now do all kinds of things with that data because you can manage it individually, or mm-hmm. you know, you can more easily manage it. You can build applications that tap into it. And it, at a higher level, this is sort of part of the wave towards companies generating so much data that they are realizing that they're missing out if they don't get some business insight from it.
Right.
So who
are like the typical customers for these kinds of companies?
Well, they have slightly different focuses. Rubrik's sort of sweet spot has been the commercial, which is also known as sort of medium-sized companies. But they've also sold into enterprises, large companies as well. Cohesity's focus has been more focused on enterprise and the larger deals that come with selling to companies of that size.
Okay. So that's what they do. So why don't you explain then how it is that these guys are now the fiercest of rivals and are kind of at the core of this sort of battle in enterprise tech?
Well, it's kind of interesting because they both, who they're really disrupting is sort of the old guard companies like Dell EMC, a company called Commvault, another company called Veritas. These companies have been around for decades and, you know, were the ones who were providing these storage and backup products. But the reason this Cohesity versus Rubrik is interesting is because the founders of each company used to work together or were colleagues uh-huh. at Nutanix. The Cohesity founder, Mohit Aaron, was the CTO of Nutanix, which is another data center company. Bipul Sinha was the founding investor in Nutanix and spent some time on the board of that company. And so mm-hmm. they were colleagues in that way. Long story short.
And did well by each other.
Yeah. No, Nutanix was really a very similar company to Rubrik and in some ways Cohesity a decade ago, because Nutanix burst on the scene with a promise of, hey, you can get rid of your storage hardware and just right. run our software to kind of replace storage. And that was a huge value proposition.
Yeah, okay, so that's a history to then. So how do they get from, you know, being on the same side to now, you know, embodying this issue?
Yeah, so they basically, Mohit left and started Cohesity. Bipul was a VC at the time. He later moved on. He was at Bloomberg Capital and he moved on to Lightspeed. He left Lightspeed and went to start Rubrik with some of his industry colleagues. So anyway, fast forward to today. I mean, they're both doing really well. They've both landed a ton of funding and are getting a ton of attention. But, you know, Rubrik is still kind of seen as ahead. Our story sort of reiterated that in some ways, but also pointed to some momentum that is happening on the Cohesity side, specifically with large customers.
Yeah. But how bitter does this rivalry really get? I mean, like, at what about this makes it stand out from, you know, traditional, just, you know, competitive, you know, two companies trying to go after the similar customers?
I think, you know, in some ways, the rivalries that happen between former colleagues and former, you know, people who are friends can be more pronounced. And that was something we also mentioned in the story. That's one thing. And then the other thing is, if you like, these two startups are kind of revolutionizing this market that was really boring and where not a lot of innovation had happened for some time. And I think part of it is that they kind of each wonder, like, man, if you weren't here, we'd be getting all the glory.
Right.
And so they have to share the glory. And then there's an element of, you know, I don't know what the word is. It jealousness or...
Sure.
They're jealous of each other, but they probably do resent the existence of the other.
Right. Resentment. Sure. I mean, and they don't, because you hear so often in tech, especially as a reporter and usually when someone's speaking on the record, they'll say, oh, you know, rising tides lifts all boats. And we're just trying to build this. We're going after the big guys. We're not really competing against the other ones. Why is that less the case here than maybe I know I see, you know, in the stuff that I write about?
Well, part of it is the real battleground for now and in the future between them is in the enterprise market, the going after large companies like JP Morgan, various industry segments like insurance, healthcare. Like it's kind of, you know, if you step back, that's kind of the battle that's happening in cloud computing in general right now. And these companies, Rubrik and Cohesity, are not necessarily cloud companies. They also, like, their product like runs in a data center. It works with cloud, but mm-hmm. it's not, you would call this like a hybrid type. These are hybrid type companies. But I think, you know, there's enough room for them both to succeed. And you're now seeing some of the incumbents realizing that, hey, wait a minute, you know, this new approach to data management is the future.
Right.
And you're starting to see some signs that those older companies are getting their act together and updating existing products and coming out with new ones.
And any chance that they merge? I mean, is this a situation where there really does need to be a single winner in the space?
I don't think so. I think that both of them can probably succeed. There have been cases before. I mentioned Nutanix. Nutanix used to have a rival called Simplivity. And they,
great names.
Back in the sort of early 2011, 2012, these companies were slugging it out in public and, you know, putting out like products with, you know, our specs are better than your specs. And there was a big battle. Well, Simplivity kind of fell behind and ended up getting acquired by Hewlett Packard Enterprise mm-hmm. a couple years ago. Another interesting battle that has some parallels here. Two companies in what was known, what's called flash storage, mm-hmm. Pure Storage and Nimble Storage. And they had sort of slightly different approaches to on the engineering side. And there were other important differences between the companies, but both going after the same pie.
Uh-huh.
Nimble Storage ended up getting acquired by, again, HPE a few years ago. So the point is that, you know, you could possibly see that scenario where maybe one of them makes it to IPO and the other one gets acquired. I don't know if you can really say at this point how that's going
to
play out.
It's interesting, Kevin. This kind of sounds like the battles that you would hear about 10, 20 years ago. Are we just returning to that era again?
It absolutely is. And that to me is what makes it so interesting. And, you know, the gloves are off. I can't wait to see what happens next between these companies.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you'll be reporting on it. All right. Thanks, Kevin.